In fact, you in Oregon, of all places, we shouldn't even be talking about this problem. Good morning, Kelly. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We're actually here to talk about it. So one of the things we wanted to...
I want to finish introducing Kelly. Okay. Excuse me. Kelly Caldwell, my guest, is a food security activist with GMO-Free Oregon. And it's important to know about that website, and you're going to find out why in just a moment. Go ahead, Kelly.
First of all, we're going to take a look at Southern Oregon and what's happening right now in Jackson County. As you may know, there's Measure 15119, which would protect Jackson County family farmers from genetically engineered crops. The farmers and activists and concerned folks in Jackson County and in other places around the state have done a great job organizing, but what we see time and time again is that the well-funded opposition comes from out of state to try to drown out our message. In the last week, we've learned of almost $500,000 contributed by Monsanto and a total of $812,000 that the opposition campaign has raised, which is entirely from outside of Jackson County and largely funded by the pesticide and chemical industries that don't want to limit genetic engineering and that kind of farming in Oregon. So there's a press release this morning. There's a press conference at the Jackson County Elections Office at 11 a.m. this morning, April 8th, in Jackson County in Medford. And so if you want more information about that, the Family Farms Coalition and the GMO-Free Jackson County are the folks to talk to about that. But there's things happening closer, too. This week, we've had volunteer organizing meetings in Eugene and Portland regarding the Oregon Right to Know ballot initiative, which would require genetic engineering labeling for foods. And that kickoff has just started. And the big thing to know about is this Wednesday from 5 to 7, there's going to be free ice cream from Ben and Jerry's and information about the Oregon Right to Know campaign. That's going to be at the Left Bank Building, 240 North Broadway. We're going to see Jerry Greenfield there. He's the co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, and he's there to support the campaign to label GMOs. And once again, that's free ice cream and a no-host bar and snacks offered at the Stingray Cafe at the Left Bank Building, 240 North Broadway, 5 to 7 tomorrow afternoon.
And even if I believe that we are able to somehow pound through legislation that requires companies to label GMO products or GMO-containing products, there are so many ways that they have of getting around that fact, the euphemisms that are used.
Yes, the idea of natural. Many things that are genetically engineered are labeled quote-unquote natural. And in the case of people who choose to eat meat, they really are at particular risk because what's happening is genetically engineered soy and corn, cottonseed, seed, alfalfa, canola, those things are being fed to fish, to chicken, to pigs, to cows. And there's lots of evidence that that is bad for those animals and bad for the humans that are eating that meat.
And because, of course, with animals, generationally, it's easier to observe the long-term effects. Because if you have generations that turn over every 5, 6, 7 years.
There are so many deep aspects to cover. One thing that I want to...
We're out of time for right now.
March Against Monsanto. Can we give a heads up about May 24th?
Let's mention that.
Yeah. And, May 24th, 11 a.m. at Holiday Park in Portland, Oregon, is going to be a March Against Monsanto. Save the date.
And we'll be inviting Kelly back to talk more about that as the date approaches. All of this information, too, remember, is available on the KBOO website. We're going to speak now with Steve Horn, investigative reporter, and an extraordinary resource for stories that you do not hear, not on the right-wing mainstream, not on Fox, and not on the left either. If you have not heard about this company, ANR, Steve is here to change that. Good morning, Steve, and thanks for being with us.
Good to be back.
It's great to have you. So I was I think I may have come across this. I have read a great deal about this. I've talked to a lot of people. Can you talk a little about what the A&R pipeline is and where it stands right now as far as completion? Also, how the hell can they keep doing this legally?
Yeah, well, so A&R pipeline system has actually existed for quite a long time. It's a gas, it's a interstate gas pipeline system that's been in existence since 1945. At that time, there was no such thing as fracking, hydraulic fracturing, no shale gas. So it was conventional gas, mostly imported to the United States, and that's the important kind of one of the important parts of the story is that it connects from Louisiana up to predominantly the Midwest, actually, so where I live, which so goes up to from Louisiana up to Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and then actually out to the Heartland westward. So it's a big web. It's a pretty incredible map of pipelines that they have. So in the Heartland, it goes to states like Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, et cetera. And importantly, things have changed since 1945. Fracking has come into existence. It's actually right around the time where it was first being tested, although it took decades for it to become huge as it is now. And right now, A&R is being transitioned from conventional gas pipeline. Actually, it was so the transition took place in the 2000s, and it was carrying gas obtained from fracking in the Haynesville Shale out of Louisiana, which is a major field. And it was going still that same route up to the Midwest. That's changed recently, or it's going to change, because the Haynesville Shale is, and this wasn't really in my article, but I think it's important to point out, it's in decline right now. It's kind of at peak production levels as of December 2011, and it's going downhill pretty quickly, as pointed out in Drill Baby Drill, which is a report by Post Carbon Institute written by David Hughes. So because that one is peaking, although we have this narrative in the United States that there's 100 years of shale gas under the ground, that's not true, as pointed out in that same report. It's important that this pipeline had to be kind of shifted and retooled for another purpose. So now that same gas will go through the shale gas obtained from fracking, but from a different field will go through it. And my piece points out it's going to go from the Utica Shale in Ohio and the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and actually go southward. And it kind of shows the big macro shift that's taking place in the U.S. as this sort of export colony for fracked gas. And this gas is, you know, TransCanada owns this pipeline, same owner as Keystone XL. They admit in their press releases that a big reason for this pipeline and the shift in directions, the reversal flow of gas, is to go to the export market down in Louisiana. And Louisiana happens to be the only state where an export terminal has been given final authorization by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which it was given in late 2012. So that's the Sabine Pass LNG export terminal. And
FERC many must be suffering from writer's cramp from signing off on all of this stuff. We've got it out here too. Steve, we were pretty much out of time at the moment. Can you give listeners the source for this piece that you've done? It's an extraordinary piece of work, and I'm constantly impressed with this. I thank you so much for joining us
today. Yeah, well, the article was titled A&R Pipeline Introducing TransCanada's Keystone XL for Fracking, and I encourage people to check it out. I'm going to be.
Well, we haven't even got into the safety issues, of which there are many in this so-called transition.
Absolutely.
My guest has been investigative reporter Steve Hornback. Again, thank you so much for that, Steve. This has been A Cascadia for Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. Janet Anderson engineered the show today. Thanks so much for that, Janet. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. My other guest has been Kelly Caldwell. And this has been A Cascadia. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Flashpoints, immigrants' rights activists rise up across the country in a call for an immediate halt to Obama's massive deportation program that has now reached 2 million people. We'll speak to the leader of the Protect Our Families, Save the Children campaign about their work to get school boards all over the country to take an active stand against deportations. And we'll feature an extended Flashpoints report on a protest for immigrants' rights in downtown San Francisco on Friday, which led to several dozen arrests. And also on the show tonight, the U.S. government is caught trying to destabilize Cuba using Twitter and other social media. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, starting last Friday, immigrants' rights groups across the country, around the states, have been organizing, acting, going into the streets, taking various actions, calling for humane immigration legislation and reform. The Obama administration has broken the record now, apparently reaching some 2 million deportations. First, we take it to Los Angeles, and we're joined by Angela Sanbrano. She is with Red Mix, I believe, and they are a part of a collective group of community action groups, schools, politicians who are taking action in L.A. It's called Protect Our Families, Save the Children campaign, to save the children. Well, welcome to Flashpoints, Angela Sanbrano. It's good to have you with us. Can you just give us an overview? What has been going on in L.A., in the surrounding communities, in Huntington Park and Bell, Los Angeles, that has inspired this kind of mass action?
This is the campaign Protect Our Families and Save the Children campaign. It's part of the national coordinated actions that are taking place throughout the country to pressure President Obama to stop deportations and to extend deferred action to all the undocumented immigrants that will qualify under a legalization law, a federal law. We know that the federal government is basically has not had the capacity or the political will to pass immigration reform. And in the meantime, President Obama is deporting over 1,200 people a day. And so at the rate he's going, he's already reached 2 million people, and we have no idea how many more million it would be deported if he continues to basically not do anything to stop the bleeding of the community and the separation of families. So we started last December, the council member Gil Cedillo from the city of L.A. introduced a resolution to calling on President Obama to stop deportations and to extend deferred action, like pretty much like he did to the youth that were brought to the United States when they were children, to all the immigrants that would qualify under possible legalization legislation. So it passed in the city of Los Angeles, and since then we've had resolutions in the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, the city of Chicago, the city of Tallahassee, we are Santa Ana, California, and today the Huntington Park, the city of Huntington Park will hear the resolution. The city of Bell would hear the resolution on Wednesday, and on tomorrow, the Los Angeles Board of Education will hear the resolution, and we expect it to pass in all of those three, the city councils and the LAUSD Board of Education. So it's part of this movement to get President Obama to make his promise that he was going to do everything in his power, to use the power of the pen, as he said, to do the kinds of things that Congress, because they are paralyzed at the federal level that he was going to do. And this is one thing that we know he has the executive power to do.
Well, he, of course, already did it. We're speaking with Angela Sanbrun. As you said, Angela, he did it for what's known as the Dreamers. So he clearly has the power in his pen. Let me ask, just to give people an idea of how many people are affected. Now, we're talking about, for instance, the Los Angeles School District, the second largest school district in the U.S. after the city of New York. It has 700,000 students, and 73% are of Mexican or Latino origin. This is huge in Los Angeles. And obviously, a lot of people are being affected in many ways, aren't they?
Right, exactly, because what happens is that when parents are detained, or right now we have 32,000 people that are being detained to waiting deportation. So imagine what happens to the children that whose parents are in detention. Obviously that has a huge impact on their ability to study. They're constantly afraid of coming home and not finding their parents. And so it is having this broken immigration system, and President Obama's insistence in continuing this deportation of and separation of families is creating a huge humanitarian crisis in our community. And you're absolutely right. We're talking about 700,000 students, and 73% of them are Latinos, the majority of Mexican descent. And this is why my organization, the Mexican